From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on, those special Friday night and the Saturday morning open lines. Here's what's happening. A story we've been following for some time now. Unbelievable. The toll now of a growing outbreak of fungal meningitis continued to rise with now 21 deaths. 271 people confirmed infections linked to contaminated steroid shots from a Massachusetts pharmacy. Unbelievable. His name is Vincente Marcelloni. He's 60 years old, an Italian businessman. He fell ill after using a handset at work for up to 6 hours a day, every day for 12 years. Now, Italy's Supreme Court in Rome has blamed his phone, saying that there is a causal link between his illness and phone use. He said he was on the phone using the mobile phone for at least 5 or 6 hours every day at work. Now, British scientists have claimed that there is insufficient evidence to prove any link to the mobile cell phones. But the court in Italy said, yes, there is. A little bizarre story. Los Angeles police are investigating 12 unsolved homicides from the 1960s to see whether there might be a connection with the Charles Manson killings. Police have not disclosed details of the homicides that apparently took place in areas near where Manson was known to hang out. Investigators hope to get access to audio tapes recorded in 1969 between Charles Tex Watson, one of the Manson's followers, and now deceased attorney Bill Boyd. A lieutenant commander says they're doing this for the families of the victims. Pat Brown is a nationally known criminal profiler. Pat, first of all, let me ask you, why has this taken so long to come forward?
Well, you know, those old attorney-client privileges that they're not supposed to release those kinds of things. And, it's kind of funny because, you know, we're talking about 40-year-old crimes now, and they're not going to prosecute these things. You know, clearly that's not going to happen. So the most they can do is tell the families, yep, we think that's the guy that did it. It's the Manson guys. And maybe they can close the cases. You can do that administratively and then take them off your open list and make yourselves look better. I think they're more curious than anything else, to tell you the truth. I think they just want to listen to the tapes.
Yeah, I think so too.
It's one of those things that's historical. It's like, oh, that'll be cool. You know, sit around and drink some beer and listen to these tapes. But, you know, it's not going to provide real justice for anybody. So,
Pat, it would not doubt me to know that the Manson and his followers had something to do with these 12 unsolved killings.
Well, you know, the kind of people that they were, I wouldn't put anything past them either. I think you're right. Essentially, you're talking about Charles Manson, who is an opportunist. He's got a lot of grandiose thinking, and this is really a royal piece of crap. So, you know, anything that comes across his way that he feels like taking care of or using or abusing or disposing of, I don't think he's got a particular problem with it. So I wouldn't be surprised if they, you know, stole things from them or, you know, just for the fun of killing did it.
You got that right. Pat, thank you so much. Police in France say that they are trying to identify the skeleton of a man believed to have been laying undiscovered in bed for more than 15 years. It doesn't get any stranger. A survey of about 1,000 Americans finds that more than 4 in 10 admit that they don't have more than $500 in readily accessible savings. Catherine Austin Fitz is with us. Catherine, this is deplorable. 4 in 10 and all they have is about $500?
George, in the last 15 years, thanks to the Department of Justice, I've been in that situation. And I tell you, it's a faith walk. America is experiencing very significant unemployment. I think the real unemployment rate is about 23%. And we're watching price inflation move up at about 5 to 10%. If you look at the real statistics, not the government statistics. So there's a big squeeze, George, as incomes are falling and expenses are rising. People are absolutely getting squeezed, and you are seeing more and more families live hand-to-mouth, particularly because we've seen housing prices drop a lot, asset prices, and nobody's getting yields on their bank deposits. Yields are, you know, all the way down, so savers are getting hurt. So this is a hard time, and a lot of people have been holding on through the elections, which, of course, If anything, we're going to see a 1-2 congressional central bank punch on most households next year in response to the way they want to renegotiate and re-engineer the budget. So this is going to be a very hard time for households, George, and slow burn is going to be the predominant economic scenario, sort of squeezing household budgets for some time to come.
Catherine, we're getting very close to the election. Does this economy help or hurt any of the two candidates? Which ones?
Well, you know, we saw the central bank. On September 13th, the Fed announced QE3.
Yeah.
And that's going to strongly support the incumbent. And, of course, I think there are many parts of the market that want the incumbent because traditionally a Democrat and an incumbent is usually better for the stock market, at least in the short run. So at the same time, you know, unemployment is really dogging the administration. And so, you know, we've seen the polls get closer over the last 2 weeks, and I think the economy is going to be number one, number two, number three issue. And you know, if the unemployment numbers keep sneaking up, it's going to put pressure on this administration.
I think so, too. What's new at Solari.com, Catherine?
Well, we're doing financial salons for changing times. I've got one in Petaluma tomorrow in Sonoma County in Northern California, and then another one in Santa Cruz in November, so you can learn more about it at our website. But, you know, George, it's amazing, amazing discussions. We call them salons because it's a more intimate discussion. But people are getting really smart, and it's not surprising that my audience is when I talk to them about how they got so smart. They say, you know, we listen to Coast to Coast.
They are brilliant people. Catherine, you have yourself a good weekend.
You too.
All right, Catherine Austin Fitz. A small asteroid that exploded over San Francisco Bay Area on Wednesday night, shaking houses with its sonic boom, might have scattered pieces of itself on the ground as well. That's the conclusion of some of the folks at the NASA Ames Research Center. Next weekend, Earth will pass through a stream of debris from Halley's Comet, source of the annual Orionid meteor shower. Forecasters expect 25 meteors per hour when the shower peaks on October 21st. Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates with us. Stephen, another exciting moment in the skies, huh?
Oh, George, it's always wonderful, and it's great to listen and talk with the coast listeners here. But this is an exciting weekend as you're building up to the meteor shower. Folks, don't miss this one. If your weather and skies are clear, look due east. And right now, George, I'm sitting out here in Arizona looking up into the east, and this radiant of the Orionid meteor shower will rise soon. So for everybody listening, just look out there into the east. You'll see the bright planet Jupiter. You can't miss it. So to the left of Jupiter by about 15 degrees, George, the sky show starts to get really good after midnight. And they're right. Maybe the astronomers are right on this one. Maybe 30, maybe 40, maybe 50 meteors per hour. But the coolest thing, and you alluded to it, these are debris from the most famous of all comets called mankind's comet, Comet Halley. So if you're like me, and I add my age of 56, 49 years from now, Halley's returns, that would make me 105 years old. So I think it's time to go out and take a look right now, don't you think?
Let's hope you're still reporting for us, Stephen, by that time, huh?
George, and I appreciate your time. And check us out on our other site at photorecon.net for all these great stories about everything from astronomy, space, aviation, and weather.
That's Dr. Stephen Cates. And up next, we're going to be talking with Dr. Bob Curran as we go live to the United Kingdom, A Haunted Mind. Ooh, that's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Here's one of our Coast to Coast favorites, Dr. Bob Curran. He was born in a remote area in Northern Ireland at the age of 14. He left school. He became a grave digger and eventually worked at a number of jobs, including professional rock musician. He was a journalist, still is, has written a number of books. Bob attended university where he took his doctorate, earned several degrees, became a teacher. We're talking about his latest work, A Haunted Mind, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Bob, how are you?
How are you, George? It's great to talk to you again.
You too. Hey, do you celebrate?
And their viewers.
Do you celebrate Halloween out that way?
We do, yes. It is getting more and more of an event here. For many years, whenever I was growing up, Halloween was never talked about it because it was a scary part of the year. But now it's becoming more and more elaborate, if you like. For instance, there's a city not too far from me, Londonderry City, which puts on 2 or 3 days of a Halloween event, and which skeletons walk about the street. There's fireworks, there's all sorts of things. Now, that would not have happened whenever I was growing up. There's bus tours. In fact, I'm taking a haunted bus tour myself to part of the North Antrim coast, and we're looking at places which have very sinister tones. Later on, I'm taking people to a vampire's grave. So this is the sort of thing that's being done now. In the past, it was, as I say, it was not a massive event, although people knew about it and tended to stay indoors.
What does a vampire's grave look like, Robert?
Well, the vampire's grave that I'm taking them to, I think it's around about the 2nd or 3rd of November. A vampire's grave is not a massive tomb or anything. Out in the country, it is it's not even in a graveyard. It's in the middle of a field. And if I can tell your listeners just a wee bit about it, it is the grave of an ancient Celtic chieftain who allegedly drank blood and who is mentioned in A General History of Ireland by Dr. Geoffrey Keating, which was written between 1629 and 1631. And it is a massive stone, and there's a massive tree, which fir-sized tree, which grows over it, and it is in the middle of a massive hollow, and there is a very dark and brooding countryside all around it. It is. There is a massive stone, a massive tree, or a large tree, and nothing will grow around it.
Jeez. Is there a stake through his heart?
No. He's buried upside down. forget all about George, the driving of the stake through his heart. That only occurred in certain instances, and you had to be very careful of the wood that you used, because in various cultures, the wood was slightly different. For example, among the Scots, you had rowan. Among the Slavs, you had yew. Among the Russians, you had oak. And if you got the wood wrong, you could be in big trouble. This guy is buried upside down. He has been slain with a sword made of yew wood. And there's the massive stone, as I said. If the stone is lifted, he could get up, George. So I'm recommending that nobody touches the stone. They can touch me if they like, but not the stone, because he might get up and prowl about.
Well, if he does that, who knows what would be unleashed, Robert?
Well, we literally don't know, George, and I wouldn't like to find out.
These vampires, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in this world with vampires, and we're going to spend some time talking about A Haunted Mind.
Okay. I have actually a new book coming out at Halloween, George, called American Vampires.
You're pretty prolific. My gosh, you just got this other one out.
That's one which should be out. In fact, I am sitting with a copy of it right in front of me, George. It is not officially in the shops yet, but I think within the next week or so it will be.
What's the theme of American Vampires, Bob?
I don't know how you think we view you, George. Everybody thinks of America as America. And that's New York. And it's New York, and which is where mainly we in Europe come into. So we tend, but America's not like that. I am literally, George, just back from America. I was in Wyoming and Colorado.
Beautiful country.
Beneath the surface of America is an older, everybody thinks, oh, America's a young country. There is the traces of older countries bubbling beneath the surface of America. And this is because America has been colonized by the British, the French, the Spanish, whatever, the Germans. And they have all brought their nightmares with them, if you like, one of which is the vampire. Now, everybody thinks we know what a vampire looks like. It's a big man in a cloak with a pale face or so, or else it's an angst-ridden teenager who lives in the small town and attends college and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's neither of those because people, the immigrants, brought various forms with them. For instance, up in New York, saying we're talking about New York, you have the notion of the Nachtmari. Now, the Nachtmari are night visitors who come and attack you at night. These are Dutch and from the edges of the German country. Further south, in, let's say, South Carolina, you have vampires who can take off their skins and who are not driven out by the sign of the cross. They're driven out by the color blue.
The color blue?
Blue.
Why would blue do that, Robert?
It is from an old African, because the predominant culture down there, or one of the main cultures down there, is the Gullah culture. From the time of the Rice Kings in South Carolina, when the Rice Kings, because rice was a massive export down there, brought in slaves from Angola and who settled all through the area and became part of the Gullah culture. In North Carolina, the emphasis is on the what we might call the Scots-Irish. We over here we call them Ulster Scots, but the Scots-Irish who settled all through the mountains, and they have they brought with them the nightmares of whales, which can drink you, George. You don't drink from the well; the well drinks you. It takes away your energy. We have them here; they're known as famine whales. And not so long ago, I took a crowd to a well, which was supposed to be vampiric, in southwest Fermanagh. And I mentioned this in the book. So you have a whole range of cultures coming in. I mean, you have notions of the French, of the Germans, of the Spanish. These cultures all have made up America, and they have brought their vampires with them. Again, they have made animated certain aspects of the things which they brought with them, because there's a very interesting story which appears in the book from Tennessee, which deals with a vampire chair.
A vampire chair? What the heck is that?
If you sit in the chair, George, it can begin to draw the energy from you. Now, put out of your mind that all vampires drink blood, because they don't. They can drink various things. The Aswang of the Philippines, for example, can drink sweat from a sleeping, and they don't bite into your neck or bite. The Aswang drinks with a long and hollow tongue. But a vampire, some of the vampires can actually draw energy from you. And if you sit in the chair, which was supposedly appeared in Tennessee, and there's supposed to be a number of stories about it, some of which are recounted in the book, but it will draw the energy from you. And you can be left debilitated, you can be left ill, you can be left almost dying.
It's almost like a psychic vampire. Bob, we're going to come back. We're going to talk more and also get into your work on H.P. Lovecraft on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll take some of your haunted stories with Dr. Bob Curran. When we come back with him, we'll talk more about American vampires and a haunted mind as well. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Bob Curran with us. Bob, you say that some vampires drink blood, others don't. How come?
Some of them, as I was saying before the break, George, drink other things. They drink, for example, sweat. They drink they drink semen. Some vampires will drink that. This explains certain aspects when young men awake in the, or very young men awake in the morning and find that there have been things like, let's say, nocturnal emissions. Others simply drink energy. For instance, vampires in the southwest, in Mexico, travel about like balls of light and attach themselves to various people as they sleep, and draw from them by osmosis. We were talking about a vampire chair as well. Various parts of furniture, inanimate things, or seemingly inanimate things, can draw from you. These balls of light or spirits or whatever you want to call them can inhabit the various things, or so the people believed, and draw from you. This explains why you get up in the morning. I know you never get up in the morning, George, and feel down or hungover. You're a bright, breezy person every morning.
I try to be, Bobby.
In the morning and feel a bit down, feel a bit tired, feel a bit weak. And this explains they have been visited by something at night, Nachtmarie, or something similar, a night visitor, who has drawn off their energies in some way, not necessarily by drinking from blood, because no vampire, it looks well in Hollywood, but no vampire drinks from the jugular vein in the neck, because if you bit through the jugular vein in your neck, you would create a massive mess and you would die instantly.
Bob, some people...
No vampire. Some vampires drink from the ankles. Some vampires drink from where a practice nurse would possibly take a blood sample from you in the crook of your arm. Some vampires drink actually from the soles of your feet. So you pay as your money, you take your choice, George.
I guess so. Now, some people are psychic vampires and they don't even know it. They don't know that they're draining energy from people.
Mm-hmm. That is actually true. You have been, I am sure, in the company of people, and you come away tired and exhausted. This can be almost like a psychic phenomenon in which they're leeching, like a leech, energy off you. Now, some of them can do it deliberately, but some, as you quite rightly say, don't even know. People claim that such people have been inhabited by certain forces or whatever at a very early age, and have grown up with it and have the ability to do that almost unconsciously. Some people, as I say, do it deliberately, and some legends specify that people perhaps increase their lifespan or make themselves much more vigorous or whatever they through leeching energy off other people. But what I would say to you, George, is watch who you sit beside in the train,
yes,
or on the bus or whatever, because they could be leeching energy off you.
A Haunted Mind, one of your latest works, Bob,
yep.
The World of H.P. Lovecraft. Tell me, what was it that got you so fascinated about him?
Many years ago, whenever I was living out in the wilds of the country, now, George, we had no electricity for many years. So reading lamps and stuff like that, we didn't have television. So a lot of my early days were spent reading, and Lovecraft was one of the books which sort of came across to a young boy who was growing up, and it fascinated me, the sort of dark and gloomy world that he was painting. And in my youth, I began to write a bit like Lovecraft, and I think part of this is Lovecraft's appeal to the modern world, because there is no doubt, there is no doubt that Lovecraft has exerted a certain appeal on the readers, on the minds of his readers. And some have attempted to write stories and works very much in the style of H.P. Lovecraft. And this has given rise to a sort of almost an industry or a certain grouping. This is what began to appeal to me. And I think the breadth and scope and the sort of images which he was throwing out. Personally, I could relate to it because I grew up in a sort of similar sort of area as rural Providence, which Lovecraft tends to be writing about. As you know, he was born in Rhode Island. The area around me was full of old forts, earthenworks and rafts, earthenworks and things like that. And so I could relate to the sort of places that he was writing about, the sort of reclusive areas, the sort of isolated areas which he was writing about. So I suppose that's what fascinated me. And whenever Courier, the publisher, approached me and said, would you like to write a book on H.P. Lovecraft? I said yes, and the result is sitting in your hand, George.
Could be. Could be.
Yeah.
You know, Bob, he was an incredible writer of his time. What had happened to him in his youth to create that creativity?
Well, I think, and I have to be very careful about this, because people have taken great exception in some of my writings about Lovecraft. People see him as perfect. I see him basically as a tormented individual. I mean, he grew up slightly apart, and he didn't grow up in isolation, but he grew up slightly apart from other people of his age. He was not, I think, very socially gifted. In face to face, although people have argued that yes, he could meet with people, but most of his relationships with people were through long and voluminous correspondence. Now that doesn't exclude the fact that he was married, but the marriage failed. And I think he was struggling with various demons which beset him. Both his parents had died, if you like, in a sanitarium. And he was terribly frightened of becoming mad. So much of his stories carry the translation of this sort of fear of madness. Yeah. People have argued, either rightly or wrongly, I think possibly wrongly, that Lovecraft was a fascist. I don't think he was, but he had a sort of abiding fear of anything which was outside his own sort of sphere of what we might term his comfort zone, particularly foreigners who had strange ways about them.
Did he have these inner demons, Bob?
I'm using my words carefully, George, because people have, and I know that there is a great Lovecraft elite out there who have written about this and who have taken exception to a portrayal of Lovecraft which is anything less than perfect. One of them sent me an email saying, you have vilified the greatest American writer ever. Now, that says nothing for Edgar Allan Poe, for Mark Twain, for Nathaniel Hawthorne. They have sent me computer viruses, for example. But so I have to choose my words very carefully. So I think he was dealing with tormented, growing up apart and from various torments which he imagined he was suffering from.
This torment that he had, did he have inner demons?
He did. I think he did. He grew up with his mother, who, if I can use the word, cosseted. She kept him slightly apart. Now, he was not completely isolated, but he was apart, and he imagined himself as being apart. He imagined himself as an outsider, which is actually the title of a collection of his work. And he viewed himself as a person looking in on the rest of the world passing by. Now, whether or not he wished to be part of that world, or whether or not he was quite content to be an outsider, apart from that work, if you look at some of the characters that inhabit his work, these are people who are strange, who are outside the mainstream of normal society. Lovecraft didn't work. I think he worked for about a week. He didn't have to work. There was money in the family, from Lovecraft's mother's family.
He died at a young age.
Money soon ran out, and he died almost in penury. But at the same time, he didn't work tremendously in the sense that you and I, nor did he see that he would have to work. So that kept him outside. You know, whenever you and I are in hard times, we feel we have to get a job or something. Lovecraft didn't see himself like that. He considered himself to be outside the mainstream. He considered himself to be somewhere apart. Whenever the war broke out, the First World War, he went to enlist, as many Americans did at the end of the First World War, and then decided against it. He didn't feel he had to fight. His mother came down and to the recruiting area and brought him home, and he quite willingly went home. Now, he concerned himself to be apart. Whenever he was married, he lived for a while apart from his wife. I think she was he was in New York in Red Hook. She worked in Cincinnati. He lived the life of a man about town. He lived off her money. She for a while was quite wealthy. So he felt that he was apart. He didn't have to engage tremendously. Now, he did engage, of course, but he didn't feel that he had to engage tremendously with the world. And this is what this internal vision or apartness gives his work the force that it does, and which has inspired so many people to write in connection with what is called the Hulu mythos.
He died at 47, Bob. One of his influences, Edgar Allan Poe.
That's right. He died of a form of cancer. He was greatly taken with Poe. Poe, of course, and I suspect that he, to some extent, identified with Poe, because Poe was a man also fighting his demons. Poe fought his own demons through drink and drugs. In some ways, he may have looked at Poe and modeled himself to some extent on Poe. And Poe, I think, provided more of an influence than we think on Lovecraft himself.
In his writings at the time, how was he perceived? Was he a giant in the industry?
No. We compare him with some of the great writers who wrote massive books. Lovecraft wrote mostly pulp fiction. Now, pulp fiction was regarded to some extent as a lesser fiction, perhaps not today. But certainly around the time, it was regarded as slightly lesser fiction. This was for the various what were called pulp magazines. Some of them centered around the supernatural. Some of them centered around things in outer space and thing, or in lost kingdoms, in Earth's prehistory. For example, another pulp writer was Robert E. Howard, who came from Cross Plains, Texas. He wrote the more famous Conan the Barbarian, which is featured in a whole raft of films. But this was regarded as a slightly lesser fiction. Now, during Lovecraft's time, he started out writing, in my view, more or less supernatural things concerning old gods and old forces which had existed since the early, before Christianity, and were still sleeping in the hills around Rhode Island and in other parts of the world. The trend at the time, for instance, in the 1930s, amongst some of these pulp fictions, was to look at lost kingdoms. I mean, Howard's work was swashbuckling. He had written Conan. He had written Solomon Kane. He had written none of them tremendously historically accurate, but all a tremendously good read. And also, you had stories of other planets, other worlds, things like that. And the notion of the pulp fiction began to shift, and I think Lovecraft began to shift his work with it. And he made the things which were originally sleeping beneath the hills from time immemorial have come from outer space. They had come and they were connected to a wider cosmos. And this opened a whole new range for those who would follow him and who would write stories in his vein. Now, some critics have said that his work is not terribly good. His own work, you ask, was he a literary giant? Some people would say no, he wasn't.
Well, see, I would say, Bob, because he was such a great horror and science fiction writer that he was spot on during his day. Bob, we're going to take this break. We're going to come back, talk a little bit more, and also take phone calls specifically about vampires
when we come right back.